It's like having a big bar if you're an alcoholic. And the other thing is, if I said to my kids, look, I'm an alcoholic and we have alcohol around the house, I want to drink alcohol. But most people don't see that about food. Whereas I think they can see that if, I mean, there's enough, understanding of alcoholism as a disease in the culture, but I am shocked to the degree that medical people don't understand that eating disorder is just the same.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real-life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to today's show. Hey, today's conversation, it's a deep one, but it's also very hopeful. I am going to be sitting down with Seattle author Allie C. Hall, who is a writer, speaker, and longtime recovery advocate whose debut novel, As Far As You Can Go Before You Have to Come Back, was 30 years in the making. It's a psychologically rich story about a young woman who journeys across Asia and ultimately finds healing through creativity, spirituality, and the slow, non-linear work of recovery. But hey, this episode is not just about a book. It's about what happens when trauma lives quietly in the background of your life, and how trauma can shape your relationship with food, with your body, with parenting, with identity, sometimes for decades. And I know there's people listening who have a history of trauma and know all about what that is and probably can relate to a lot of what we're going to talk about today. She's going to share her early experiences with eating disorder recovery, how creativity became a lifeline, and her experience with 12 steps and what that support meant to her, and what it was like to return to treatment later in life during postpartum depression and perimenopause. We're going to talk about something we don't discuss enough in recovery spaces, that long arc of recovery, the ebbs and flows. I know, I've brought it up in here before, but recovery is not linear. And the fact that healing isn't linear and that struggling does not erase the work you've done, when you have those ebbs and flows, all the work you've done, it doesn't mean you haven't done it. It just feels that way sometimes. And so I think it's really important we talk about that. And like I said, we're also going to talk about parenting after trauma, hypervigilance, group support, and why creativity can sometimes reach places that traditional therapy can't. So this conversation is thoughtful, it's candid, it's nuanced. And for anyone who's ever wondered, hey, why does this stuff still come up for me? How do I keep going without shame? Look, if you've ever felt like your healing journey doesn't look neat or, Instagram ready or textbook, this is really for you. So I just want to go grab our guest and dive in. So sit back, relax, and listen. All right. Well, Allie, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi. So I am so interested to hear about you and your story. And I'm going to let you just kind of start us out with where you'd like to, let us know about you, your life. So I'll let you kind of take the lead on that one.
Okay. Well, I got into 12-step program when I was 23 for eating disordered. Then I got into a program, and I spent a year coming to terms with what does it mean to have a power greater than yourself. I just could not see past that. I was so annoyed, really, thoroughly annoyed, because I have this strong feminist side, and I did not like the male, it doesn't matter if you called him he or she, there was a male essence to the God of, you know, Judeo-Christian life, liturgy. And being in Japan, I started practicing Tai Chi. I'm sorry, I didn't say that. After college, I moved to Japan, and that is where I got into program. Okay. And I started practicing Tai Chi, which is actually Chinese. So don't ask me why that happened. That's just, I'm just not a kendo person or whatever. I don't like bapping people on the head. And that really brought a real kind of just earth energy to whatever I perceived of as spirituality. Tai Chi is all based on circles, and you move this circle of energy around. Mm. And that circular sort of underlying philosophy really helped me understand a God, because it wasn't good or bad or up or down. It was like, if you've seen the yin yang symbol, mm-hmm. like there's dark on this side with a white dot in the middle. And then there's white on this side with a black dot in the middle. And so at the end of everything is the beginning of the other. And that just made me relax, that whole sense of whatever's happened has happened. There's a new beginning in there, whatever you're doing. And so I was in program for 3 years when I became just able emotionally to face the abuse that had gone in my childhood. It was in terms of data of abuse. I try not to compare stories because I feel like everybody's pain is everybody's pain. But I think on some level, my sense is that if that kind of life appeals to you, something is going on. People who have like a good basis, who were luckily to bind, you know, to have relationships and bind to adults who were caring and functional, would just sort of be like, I'm not going to do that. It would just not make sense the way someone who was full of self-hatred that really belonged to somebody else, you know, it was their hatred landed on me and I took it on and became self-hatred. So in the early 90s, I went to treatment at the Meadows, which at the time was very well known for childhood sexual trauma. And they are still, but they're focused now on resolution. That's how they market themselves now. I think it's kind of hard to focus on being child sexual trauma because it's kind of negative. So I spent 6 weeks inpatient, and then I came out and I moved to Seattle specifically to work with a therapist that they recommended. Hmm. Because I had gone through there was a lot of data in my trauma file. And I worked with her for 5 years and continued to work with her for almost 25 after that. But after 5 years, I'd really started to integrate, what had happened in my childhood and who I was in the present day. And suddenly I was writing a novel about surviving sexual trauma in your childhood. I was working as a journalist, so writing wasn't an unknown thing, but it never occurred to me to write fiction.
Okay. So it wasn't like an autobiography is what you're saying.
I think emotionally it's an autobiography. I think okay. That's what they mean when they say autobiographical novel. I don't know what that means.
Okay.
You're either autobiographical or you're fiction as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, it was so influenced by what I had done in my life and what I had. Had I never gone to Asia, I never could have put her in Southeast Asia and had all those experiences. And because it's a healing journey, that it can be seen in context of Southeast Asian history and culture, I think she's able to kind of see a part of herself she might not have had she been in the United States. And there's something about being so far away that makes it safe. Yeah, I mean, the novel's called As Far As You Can Go Before You Have to Come Back, right? Because she really went as far as she can. But the coming back has to do with you can't outrun your trauma.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. And I mean, I'm wondering for you, like, it sounds like you were raised in this family where there was a lot of trauma, and it sounds like you were actually pretty young when you started to get help. And so how did that happen? If you were in this, excuse me for asking that, but if you were in this really abusive, like, family and home, how did you actually get to a place where you were given help?
I was always an artist. And I think that trauma sits in a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which holds the memory. you probably know this.
But people listening may not.
They may not. But the way my therapist here described it is that, like, the abuse sits over the creativity in the hippocampus and struggles. And when you tap into your, whatever you call your artistic side, I mean, some people do actual art, like singing or whatever. And some people express themselves in a way that is artistic to them. You know, maybe they do mini golf on the weekends, or they lead a Girl Scout troop, and they just throw themselves into that. And that creativity I always had, because when I was little, I was a tap dancer. And I honestly think in third and fourth grade, that is what saved me. I had that, to go somewhere and be good at something and just be able to, you know, express, was really helpful. And then as I got older, I stayed in the performing arts because I got such pleasure out of it. And I think that being able to tap into something that was truly expressing my pure self kept me in touch with me. And then it was the later 80s when I was in college and eating disorders were starting to hit the mainstream. I remember when I was in high school, there was this article in Life magazine about an anorexic, and they followed her around and they talked about how she felt. And it was revolutionary. Nobody thought about girls starving themselves like that as an actual disease, as opposed to, oh, just eat some food and that's the end of it, you know. And so they were, the school I went to for college, they were having seminars and stuff. And so I knew that something was wrong. I knew I had something called bulimia. I knew I couldn't stop. I knew this couldn't be okay. So I went to one of these things and there was a therapist there and I connected with her. And so I was having therapy sometime in college, and then I just stopped and was a mess. But when I went into Japan and got in touch with a 12-step program, I it was in English, by the way. I'm not a fantastic speaker of Japanese. You know, people in the program were in therapy, and I found somebody who I really liked, and I worked with her for 2 years before I just felt this inside click that made me go, okay, I can deal with this.
Okay, so when you say a 12-step program, like, can you talk about that? Because I have my own ideas about what that is, and so.
Okay, so 12-step programs are based on Alcoholics Anonymous, which developed in the 1930s. It was run by a bunch of very well-meaning, very bright white men, Christian men. So the whole thing is very white, Western Christian, which I didn't like, and I had some. I knew what 12-step was in the United States, and I knew I didn't like it because I thought you had to believe in this white Christian God. But I remember I was in my room in Tokyo sort of the second weekend I was there, and I had nothing to do. I hadn't even found a job yet. And so I was looking through the English language daily to get some job leads. And I just saw a little ad that says, having problems with food, come to OA. And I was like, yep, I'm there. And I went. And the first thing I said in a meeting was, I don't like God. I don't like the pronoun he associated with God. So what am I going to do here? And people are like, well, just keep coming back. So a 12-step program is based on Alcoholics Anonymous, but that had branched out to overeating and people, generally wives, who were married to alcoholics, called Al-Anon. And so you sit in a room and you read the opening preamble, which talks about this is who we are, and we realize we're powerless. And then there's usually a topic and people go around and share. And what's really lovely is there's no crosstalk. That's the part I really like. No one's like, well, I think you should do this. And if you did, because then everybody gets into everybody else's problems. I mean, 100 years ago, they understood that you are here for you. You are here to figure out your relationship to whatever you consider as God and how that's going to help you heal. And then there are 12 steps, which, did you want me to go into them or?
No. It's just, you know, just being honest, like I've had the impression when people are in OA, it's been kind of counter to eating disorder treatment because it's been kind of restrictive, and people have had opposite than what you've shared in terms of feeling like it's very kind of I don't know, promoting a lot of eating disorder behaviors in terms of like having to check in with sponsors and tell them exactly what they're going to eat down to like, you know, the last little molecule of food and very anti quote unquote white foods or no sugar and things like that. Right. And so it almost seems like it almost prescribes the eating disorder instead of helping like treat it. So I'm just wondering your perspective on
that. Yeah, no, because first of all, we were living in Japan, all of us. So you don't eat like that in Japan. You eat rice-based meals. You can't not eat carbohydrates and live in Japan. You'll go broke. But if you're just, you know, like, because meat is so expensive, but if you eat just a Japanese meal, it's very balancing. It's a very calming. It's based on brown rice. This is before Japan got more westernized and they moved towards white rice and more preservatives. But I tried to just eat organically along the lines of a Japanese meal. And for me, that really worked. What I do know is that there was something that first happened, I think it was in the 70s when OA first started, was the whole thought was like, well, we have to have some things we don't do, like alcoholics don't drink. So let's set up this program like you were describing, which is called the gray sheet. And the gray sheet in some form or another comes in and out of OA. But if you look at the program as it is, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop overeating compulsively, the desire to stop undereating, the desire to stop binging or overexercising. That is it. The rest are tools. So if you choose to use this tool of the gray sheet where everything is prescribed, you know, God bless, and I hope it works for you. For me and the group in general, it was a bunch of women my age, by and large. There were two older men, and bless their hearts, they kept coming back, even though they were kind of left out of the conversation, because we were all in our 20s and worried about things that women in their 20s are worried about. But we had to figure out how to eat. That became, because for me, even now, if I commit my food and I say carrots, I will eat celery. I am not going to be prescribed. That is just a part of my eating disorder. So what I need is kind of like three reasonable meals a day, a couple snacks in there, and then I'm good. But I try to release the control, because when you have bulimia and you figured out that I can overeat and vomit, restraints are really painful and they just trigger me. So sometimes, you know, my little overeater inside still wants to overeat, right? And we have to have a conversation, she and I, about like, well, what's this about? And what are you trying to achieve? And what's the benefit? Like, you really want that? I don't know. I don't know if I could do that. So that's what I think it means to be less restricted around food and still be. It takes a lot of trust. It takes a lot of trust and it takes a lot of questioning.
Well, I think everybody has their own path, their own journey, and their own reasons why they have their eating disorder, for sure. And certainly it sounds like for you, there's these foods or behaviors that you're still struggling with, which, again, everybody's got their own path, their own journey. And, you know, I really appreciate that you're sharing that you're still struggling with these things. And what I really appreciate you sharing is that you're inquisitive now. And it's like this, why is this happening? What does this mean? Instead of beating yourself up and saying, oh, I screwed up or I'm failing or, you know, shaming yourself. Because I think that's what a lot of people do, is they're having these moments and they're, you know, if you, you know, have a food and you're like, oh, you know, I want to, you know, binge on it or whatever, instead of, you know, shaming yourself or doing what I find most people do is this thing like, I can never have this food in my house again. And completely demonize it and say, no, you know, I hear this all the time. Like, doc, I can't have that food in my house. You don't understand. Like, if I have it, I'm going to eat all of it. And like, you know, I think the great thing you said is like, you're aware of these things and saying like, I'm questioning it and saying, can I do this?
You talk about beating yourself up. I was very frustrated with that for a long time. And my therapist finally said, but you have that stuff in the house. Like, it's like having a big bar if you're an alcoholic. Like, and the other thing is, if I said to my kids, look, I'm an alcoholic and we have alcohol around the house, I want to drink alcohol. But most people don't see that about food. Whereas I think they can see that if, I mean, there's enough, you know, understanding of alcoholism as a disease in the culture, but I am shocked to the degree that people, medical people, don't understand that eating disorder is just the same.
Well, I'm wondering for you though, like, are you still actively in treatment and working to like have a different relationship with food?
When I hit 45, I had my second child at 42. And so I was just stopping nursing and I had an unrecognized postpartum depression. So both are things are total setups. And then my therapist was out of town. So I was seeing somebody else and I plunged. And then my regular therapist came back and was like, what in the Sam Hill is going on? So I went back to treatment at the Meadows. I did another 6-week session there. I was in relapse from postpartum depression. It was really, so my eating disorder got really triggered when I came out because I realized, oh my God, I've just been using food for a couple years now. And I was just so lost in it that it wouldn't occur to me to pick up the phone and talk to someone about it, if that makes sense. I was just so deep in it. So I have never, I'm 60 now, and I have not really gotten back the same comfort I had with food as when I was in my mid-20s living in Japan. And then when I first came back to the United States, it's something I just still work with.
Yeah. And I appreciate that being honesty because I think, you know, people wonder like, is full recovery possible? And yeah, I know I'm a big advocate for that, but you know, oftentimes we don't hear from people who are still like years, decades later struggling. And, you know, it's not a linear path. It's like you have ebbs and flows and there are times in life where, you know, you may have more struggles like after pregnancy or during menopause or other times or big changes or losses in life. And so I appreciate you sharing all of that and, being candid.
Well, I forgot to mention that in addition to the two things I was going through, I was definitely perimenopausal. And that was like, ooh, that really knocked me out. I think one thing, I do think full recovery is possible, especially if you're willing to look at whatever happened in your childhood that set you up for that situation. You can really, I mean, I went for years and years and years, 10 or 15, without thinking about food. Pregnancy is really hard. Pregnancy, postpartum, even if you're in a lot of recovery. I also was doing so well, I made a massive mistake and I stopped going to meetings. And while I still had friends that were in the program, I wasn't working it, as people say. I wasn't making calls. And that did not serve me well when I was suddenly having a very hard time. Like it's like you got to put those dimes in there. Every time you go to a meeting is like putting a dime in a box, you know? And then when you run out of money, you've got that box full of dimes. Had I been, and I don't blame myself, that's just what happened. And I let it happen. And there were consequences, you know. So for someone, if you're someone who meetings work for or whatever structure you have, boy, keep doing that, even when you think you're all better. Yeah. Yeah. So that's just where I am with it.
Yeah, I agree. I think group can be a very powerful adjunct to individual therapy, or if you need higher levels of care like you went to. But I think it is so common for people to isolate and avoid, especially when it's at the hardest times, because it can be very shameful. Like, oh gosh, I'm going through this hard time. I don't want to talk about it. And I don't know if that was your experience and why you kind of isolated yourself or avoided.
Well, there were a lot of things going on. Number one, I had this whole new identity, which required the jettisoning of my old identity, which was mom. And suddenly I was responsible for a child when I had been abused as a child. Now, I'm not someone who's going to abuse a child physically or sexually. It's not in my nature. And at that point, I'd had too much recovery. But it was really triggering. It was very triggering. And when my second child came along, female, oh boy, that was a whole nother level of triggering. And that's when everything really, that's when I really dove into depression and had to go back to the Meadows. And I understood that intellectually, but I didn't understand in a day-to-day, like, this is what I'm dealing. Even though I was talking with my therapist about it, there was something about getting in here that really happened when I went back to treatment. And I really saw a whole bunch of more patterns. And I would just say to anybody out there who wants to get pregnant, don't be afraid of it. If you have childhood trauma of any, there's way too much help now for you to think you have to, you know, be alone and struggle with that and become your parents. You don't. You can go out there and create this new way of being by tapping into all the strength and support that other women have gone through around this.
No, thank you for sharing that, because I've heard like lots of different people having lots of different ways to recover with their trauma, whether they still maintain contact with their families or their families were part of their trauma recovery, or when they had kids, they decided to no longer have contact with their families, or when their kids were a certain age, especially the same gendered child, all sorts of things pop up. So, you know, I don't know your entire story, but, you know.
Well, kind of, yes. Everything you said sort of checks out.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So.
And that is something you have to deal with. I mean, I think if you're in recovery and you understand, I have an eating disorder, I don't eat well like most people, I need to take a special care here, then if you have trauma in your childhood and you come to parenting, you can have that same philosophy. I mean, as a parent, you have to come to terms with letting your kid go out in the world, you know? And that was very, that like ongoing pressure for like 10 years for each of the kids was a lot. I'm realizing now, like, that's a lot more than I thought I was going through. But this feeling of, I know the worst. That can happen. I know the absolute worst that can happen. Luckily, they all got through. No abuse. They function really well. I'm very, very grateful around that. Yeah, they're kind of launched or launching, and they're in college, you know, they're college age. So it's just nice to see them, and they're pretty functional, you know.
Well, it all makes sense, you know, if you had that traumatic childhood that you have that overprotection. And I've definitely heard that too from parents struggling with, do I let my kids have sleepovers? Do I not? Do all the things, and just the, you know, I don't
so
know.
So hard.
Do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you wrote this book.
I did. I have a copy. Yeah,
do you? Okay. Okay.
As far as you can go before you have to come back. I got that title because the main character, after she travels through Asia, she lands in Japan, these people that are helping her. And they are, it's not exactly a replacement for the 12-step program, but these people who practice Tai Chi, it is, Tai Chi was such a huge part of my recovery that it was just going to end up in there. It just didn't make any sense not to. But it was a nice kind of healthy framework to use, because I think books where people go to meetings are pretty boring, you know, like, I maybe because I do that in my life, I just wanted something a little more active. Yeah. So Japan is like where the sun hits the earth first every day. It's the land of the rising sun. So it's kind of as far as you can go before you have to come back. And so I like, and it also is, I think, emotionally, all of us will go as far as we can before we actually have to come back and deal with the stuff. That's, I think it's pretty much human nature to not want to deal with the hard stuff. It's hard.
Yeah, and it is. This, I mean, and when you are struggling with trauma, you're struggling with an eating disorder, depression, anxiety, whatever it is, this is hard stuff. This is really hard stuff. So anyone out there listening, you know, if you have a history of trauma, again, to your point, I love that you said that, not comparing yourself like, oh, mine wasn't that bad, or it wasn't that bad compared to anyone else's. Your trauma is your trauma.
And it's what you've experienced. Right? Yeah. And yeah. You deserve to treat yourself, you know, get some help and get happy.
Right. And so if people want to find your book, how can they do that?
Oh, it's, you know, it's wherever books are sold. So it's on Amazon. It's in a lot of bookstores. If they haven't happened to order it or it's out of stock, you can just tell them it's just an Ingram book, you know, Ingram delivers it and they love that because everybody works with Ingram. So you can get, and it's ebook, it's an audio book, however you like books.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I don't know if you have any last final words for people as we end here.
I do actually. We were just talking just a minute ago and we were talking about like, it's what you have in your life and it's, you're valued enough to go out and heal it, even if you think it's not as bad as somebody else's. I mean, I'm someone who believes in reincarnation. I have no idea if my belief is right. And some people believe in like a Christian afterlife or whatever, or they don't believe in anything. But the truth is, the only thing any of us really know is we are here now. And we got one. As far as I can see, for absolute, like the only thing I could lay money on is that we all have this life. And so I don't look at it as a dress rehearsal. This is it. Get the most out of it that you can. Treat yourself as well as you can so that you can treat the people you love as well as you can and treat the world as well as you can. And I think that's what a good life is.
Well said. It's not a dress rehearsal. So
it's not.
Absolutely. It's not. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing all that you did about your life story. I know that can be, you know, really hard and it's very vulnerable. So thank you so, so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. And thank you for doing this where you reach out to the community. It's so valuable.
Thank you again.
All righty. Have a great day.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please like, rate, and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.